And Macro Event Risk is back. Welcome, everybody. This is Macro Money. I'm Ilya Spivak, head of global macro here at Tasty Live. And you know I'm excited because we've been waiting for some economic news of weight and substance to give these markets something to really chew on. And we are finally going to get it. We are looking down the barrel of the release of first quarter U.S. GDP data coming at us in less than 24 hours. And what we are asking ourselves, of course, is will it do anything or will the markets not care? And if it does something, how should we think about it? What are the expectations? How might the results influence the markets, and is this something that has staying power? So what we're going to do here is we're going to look at what this number is expected to be, what the range of outcomes might look like, and then really focus on the price action dynamics. What do the markets want to see? And are they going to even care what comes out? Would be impactful. And then from that perspective, attempt to kind of benchmark a trading strategy around what seems to be the path of least resistance. So let's start here with just the baseline expectations. We're looking for the annualized GDP growth rate. So this is not the year-on-year growth rate. This is what happens if you take the quarterly growth rate, quarter-on-quarter, and then you extrapolate it into an annualized rate. Basically saying that the annual growth rate were every quarter to be like this quarter would be this. And so what we're looking at here is a climb down a little bit. In fact, the second consecutive quarter of climb down, we had a really blistering set of GDP numbers toward the middle of last year. As a matter of fact, 4.9% in the third quarter of last year, then a step down to 3.4 in the fourth. And this is seen as another step down to 2.5 for the first quarter. Now, why do we care? Should we care? I would argue emphatically, yes, we should certainly care. And here's the logic. If we look at the way that the stock market, broadly speaking, as a kind of bellwether, a kind of barometer for risk appetite across financial markets, if we look at the way that it's behaved and the way that it has reflected overall willingness from investors to take market risk, willingness to buy stocks, willingness to buy things like Bitcoin or commodities or corporate bonds or anything that isn't cash or ultimate safety like the treasury bond, and of course, in relative terms, we can see that the motivation has been the path of expectation for Fed rate cuts. And this makes sense. It makes sense because if you're an investor and you're faced with oceans of uncertainty in this particular moment in time, you have one of the most aggressive rate hike cycles in 40 years, and you're waiting to see what the cumulative impact is going to be, especially at a time when outstanding debt is the biggest it's ever been globally, both public and the private sector. You have now not one, but two critical wars occurring in key choke points for commodities, one in the Russia-Ukraine situation, one in the Israel-Hamas situation. And those are just the big eye-catching ones. You have an election year in the U.S. with potentially significant consequences for economic policy. Deglobalization is gaining momentum. China can't seem to get up off the mat, having reopened after COVID lockdowns, and that's the second largest economy in the world. So what does that mean for global growth? So there is no shortage of possible issues. So as an investor, how do you distill all of that? Well, what you might say is, if the cost of credit is going to be cheaper in the future, well, then I can feel much more comfortable about taking market risk in this environment because worst case scenario, I lose some money and borrow it back at lower rates. If you are then looking at what the Fed began to signal in November, as a matter of fact, November 1st was that policy meeting, and you hear the Fed saying, we think we're done hiking rates, we think the next move is going to be a cut, that's music to your ears. So it's not surprising that as we start to see the build out in interest rate cuts late October, early November, going into that Fed meeting and certainly thereafter, risk appetite thrives and stocks start going up. The Fed defines what it means by its cut expectations in late December and says, we're looking for 3 cuts in 2024. By the time the calendar year turns, the market has already veered well past that and is calling for something on the order of 150 basis points, with even a little bit optionality to go further. And then U.S. economic data starts coming out repeatedly better than expected. We start to see hotter jobs numbers. We start to see hotter inflation numbers. And what starts to happen is the markets begin chipping away at how many rate cuts the Fed can actually afford to do in that environment. You can see that here. What's interesting is that stocks continue to levitate through this effort until they don't. And so the question becomes, well, what's different here? Well, here's the Fed's baseline, 75 basis points. Until you get here, the markets are expecting more easing than the Fed is benchmarking. And so the underlying story still is, we're going to get more easing. Money is going to be cheaper than what the central bank is saying. They're going to have to make that adjustment eventually. Until they do, risk on. Because the gravitational force pulling markets up here is still the promise of relatively cheaper money. And of a Fed that will have to eventually mark a pivot that way, or at least that's what investors think. What occurs right here, and this just happens to be the March 20th Fed meeting, is that the market outlook flips on the hawkish side of Fed expectations. You get the 61 basis points baked in for the year, which is 2 cuts and a less than 50% shot at a third one. And the moment that shot at a third one gets less than 50%, in fact, within 24 hours of the Fed policy announcement, reiterating they're looking for 75 basis points or 3 cuts, which is March the 20th, within 24 hours of that, the markets top and start going the other way. You can see that right here. In this context, what the markets want, ostensibly, out of GDP data and economic data in general, is weaker data. Because if the data is weak, that would mean more rate cuts. And that would start to move this back in the opposite direction, which is, of course, at least looking at the evidence here, what the markets want to see. We got a preview of how this works in spades just earlier this week. We saw much weaker than expected PMI data out of the U.S. As you can see here, the composite coming in 50.9, much softer than the 52.2 expected, and in fact, a four-month low. Weaker on services, weaker on manufacturing, a dour report all around. So what did the markets do? Here's the S&P 500 when that data came out. Here was the previous swing high. We came down to digest into it. Came up to essentially right where that swing high is. What catalyzes it to puncture through? This is a 15-minute chart. Here's the PMI data. We sail higher thereafter. Here's the NASDAQ. Same story. Here's the preceding swing high. We digest in a range. Reset to even here. Data comes out. We punch higher. We rise since then. So the way this works is very clearly on display. The price action is showing us what the markets want to see. They want to see soft data that brings more cuts into the picture. As it happens, when that PMI data came out, we saw an instant adjustment in Fed policy odds. Now, of course, it wasn't the biggest adjustment in the world, because you would need more than a single piece of economic data to do all that. But if we take a look at the way that the markets reacted as soon as that data came, we went from 32 basis points baked in instantly down to 38. So the market immediately adjusted to something less hawkish. Stocks went up, dollar went down. So this is our benchmark. This is why we care. Now, what's the likelihood that this number deviates from 2.5%? Well, there's a range of outcomes here on display. The Atlanta Fed's GDP Now forecast, which they call a nowcast, that essentially takes in incoming economic data, puts it through a model, and gives us expectations for what GDP might be, as of today is at 2.7%. So we can see here north of where the markets are expecting it. You can see that there's the market range right there. If we look at the Fed's St. Louis branch and their model, they're a lot more on the pessimistic side of things. They think it's going to be 1.7%. In the red is that GDP Now model. That's what you see here. And in the blue is the St. Louis Fed's nowcast. The New York Fed, the other big Fed branch that does this, and admittedly they haven't updated it since the 19th, they're somewhere in the middle at 2.2%. So clearly, even at the Fed, there is a broad range of possibilities. Now, the Atlanta Fed model has been performing better recently. It's been closer, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't stumble, and it doesn't mean that economic conditions can't change such that the other models are more telling, which is to say that from 1.7 to 2.7, there's quite the spread here. Now, if we look at the way that U.S. economic data has performed relative to expectations, what we find is that, first of all, here's how we lost all of those rate cuts. We can see here data since the beginning of the year has been increasingly performing better than expected. This is an index from Citigroup, and the further it goes into positive territory, the more the data is tending to outperform relative to forecasts. At zero, the realized results and forecast would be basically in line. But what's important here seems to be how this is actually trending. And what we see is when we put a simple 20-day moving average on it, which is essentially just a month's worth of data, 5 days in a week, about 4 weeks in a month, that's crudely a 20-day running average. And so what we see is when the index pushes through the monthly dynamic, the monthly sort of average here, it tends to have follow through in that direction. So we can see here when it breaks the 20-day here, we get a period of data deteriorating. When it breaks higher, improving, deteriorating. Even when it gets stuck in a range, a break through this seems telling. We got it here again on the upside, here again on the downside, and we've just done it one more time. Now, this does look a bit range adjacent, but certainly can't be ignored that once again, we've moved through the 20-day moving average. And so maybe we're starting to see economic data biased in the direction of weaker surprises here. So perhaps what we're looking at is something like the risk of a miss. Now, to contextualize what that means and what kind of a miss is good, bad, and what does that mean? We can see that in the summary of economic projections that the Fed delivered to us in March, the same one where they reiterated their call for three cuts, consider here, that's a rate of 4.6% this year. The average Fed funds rate now is 5.33. That's the middle of their target range of 5.25 to 5.5. If we have a range of 4.6, that's a change of 73 basis points. So that's three cuts. So there's those three cuts that we were just talking about. And we can see that this is contingent on a median GDP growth rate this year of 2.1%. And the central tendency is somewhere in a range of 2 to 2.4%. Now, if that central tendency is 2 to 2.4 and the median is 2.1, the median is just the middle, not the average, but the middle. 2.1 is the middle in a range of 2 to 2.4, then the expectations here skew toward the lower end, toward 2.0, 2.1, rather than, let's say, 2.3, 2.4. So ostensibly, any number here on GDP that comes out at 2.4 or hotter, maybe even 2.3, but that's a little bit of a stretch. That would be a meaningful miss versus the 2.5 expected. But even if we miss a little and land at 2.4, in line at 2.5 or hotter, we are looking at an economy that is fundamentally trending stronger than where the Fed was when it said we're going to need three cuts. Because if we were on a pace to 2.1% growth, then the Fed would look like it makes sense. But if we're on a pace to 2.5 or even 2.4, the upper end of the range here, then three cuts look a little bit of a stretch. And so from that perspective, any range of outcomes that's 2.4 or hotter look like they are the kind of thing that would underpin the recent evaporating of Fed rate cut odds and give us the kind of thing that stocks don't like as a response. Now, besides stocks, there is, of course, the U.S. dollar, which has moved very cleanly in line with Fed policy expectations. When there were more cuts being baked in, the dollar fell. As the number of cuts started to diminish, the dollar's been rising. It's had a little bit of a back step here in the wake of those PMI numbers. But if we get a GDP number here that endorses the idea of a more hawkish Fed, then what this is going to look like is a pullback of sorts. Where this was resistance, this was a breakout, we're pulling back here, and perhaps with the strength of this GDP number, if it goes the way that we're talking about here, bounces in this direction. The other important thing to keep in mind here is, of course, the Japanese yen. And that's because not only are we going to get this GDP number, we are also going to get a monetary policy announcement from the Bank of Japan, where everybody will look for them to say something about the fact that the yen has crumbled to the lowest level in 34 years against the US dollar, and that's largely thanks to rising rates. We can see here that when we had these rate cuts getting built out, once the move really started to gain momentum here, especially, of course, lined up with the stocks rally in October, late October, early November, the yen surged. As these rate cuts started to diminish, so too did the yen. Now, for Japanese authorities, this is not the best of all possible things. It, of course, complicates their problems with inflation because it makes the yen less able to have purchasing power of foreign goods, and Japan imports most of its energy, imports most of its food. It is, after all, an island. So this would make inflation go up. This is not what they want to see. So if the GDP numbers eat further into rate cuts, or at least underpin the idea that we're going to get one maybe cut this year rather than three, and the yen gets another shove lower, then when the Bank of Japan then meets, you might get something like conversation about their discomfort with these levels, which might set the stage for them to intervene in markets as they've done before. So a potential snapback here could be violent. And that is what we're looking at here. That's macro money for today. Thanks very much for joining. As ever, I am here with this show Monday through Thursday, right after Overtime, a show that I co-host with Chris Vecchio and Dylan Radigan, looking at the Wall Street close and what it might mean going forward. I am also later today and every Wednesday on The Price of Truth with Victor Jones, his great new show. Back on with Chris on Fridays for Futures Power Hour. Back on with Victor and Tom for First Call on Sundays. Writing for the news and insights portion of tastylive.com and opining sporadically on the platform formerly known as Twitter at Ilya Spivak. Thanks very much for watching. See you tomorrow.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Life, Inc. and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be, trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tasty Live Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tasty Live Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered introducer.